On the Same Page, A Good Omens Fan Fiction by Chekhov, read by GorillasGal86. Part 5, Chapter 7. Thaddeus Dowling was not a small man. He was also not a subtle man. His very existence appeared to be preoccupied by the task of taking up as much space as possible, both physically and mentally. Whether or not this was a conscious effort was a mystery, but Crowley had his suspicions that the behavior was a defense mechanism for what might have been an underlying fear that his presence, although large, was not altogether massive. Size and mass were not the same thing after all. Mass required some amount of density, some level of substance to go in the void that filled the outer lines of an object. Dowling, thus far, had not given any reason to suspect that his incredible size was anything more than a cover-up for what was, in layman's terms, a lot of hot air. Then again, it wasn't completely unimpressive. After all, gas giants like Jupiter left quite an impression on other celestial objects despite their significant lack of density. One could spend hours arguing about the maths involved, and yet any idiot with a telescope could also point out that it was visibility that mattered to most people who stared at the night sky. Perhaps Dowling had figured this out early on. He utilized it to the best of his ability as he greeted them at the door. Slightly damp from the snowfall, and then used his boisterous American voice to tell them, loudly, that they were later than expected. And had they gotten lost? Had they perhaps forgotten how big America was? No, they hadn't, Crowley had wanted to tell him. There was a bloody snowstorm raging out there that they'd been caught in. And they'd still made good time despite it, you blasted idiot. But his ear fell, presumably knowing how such an exchange was bound to end, valiantly cut in before he could open his mouth, and made some maddeningly polite excuse of stopping to get a bite to eat. Harriet Dowling, significantly smaller, though containing much more substance than her husband, arrived then, rushing down the steps to greet them and immediately joined Aziraphale in his task of talking about safe, uninteresting things like the weather and their suitcases and their accommodations. And so Crowley's urge to fuck everything up was disabled for the time being. Just as well, he figured. It was way too early in the game to make a complete fool of himself. Why hurry on the inevitable? Might as well enjoy his stretch of luck as far as it carried him. "Your room," Harriet Dowling told them, "will be in the east end of the cottage. It's a ways away from the main part, but still connected. There's its own separate bathroom there, and a small living space in the lower level. No kitchen, I'm afraid. That's in the main part. But there's a fridge. It's a little more secluded. We didn't want you to feel like you have to worry about privacy, staying in the same cottage as us." She glanced between them meaningfully, while in the background, her husband grew visibly uncomfortable with the implications of what the privacy would be used for. Aziraphale recovered relatively quickly, or perhaps he hadn't caught on. "Oh, no, that's absolutely lovely," he assured, smiling his brilliant smile. "This place it's rather much bigger than I anticipated, to be honest. I suppose it's true what they say. Everything really is bigger in America." Thaddeus produced a hearty guffaw at this, and it seemed like the praise had steered him back into familiar territory. "Damn right," he said. "This land was my grandfather's, all 30 acres, and I figured I'd better put it to use and build something proper on it. Thought of making this into an inn. Guess you two are going to be our first guests. That can be in the book," he added, pointing to Aziraphale in a way that could be considered accusatory, were his manner not already evidenced to be mostly outlined by crudely friendly gestures. "No discussion of work yet," announced Harriet. "Tonight, let's just all enjoy a nice dinner and relax," she added and turned back to his ear fail, grabbing his hand suddenly. "I have to admit, I was really nervous about meeting you. I'm a huge fan, and you can be sure I will pick your brain, but I'll be nice about it. For now, though, I think you're tired and just want to collapse for a few hours, right?" Azir Fael, who looked startled at the contact but managed to continue holding his smile through it all, replied with a soft laugh of agreement. "Good," she announced. "The staff will show you to your room. Feel free to wander around as much as you like, but we will ask you both to join us for dinner around 7. Crowley glanced at his watch. 4:53 p.m. It wasn't as much as a few hours, but it was better than nothing. As promised, a member of the staff took them through the spacious wooden halls towards the left side of the cottage. Really, the word was not fitting for the building they were in. Although it seemed large from the outside, on the inside it was even larger, as though the snow had been hiding secret underground levels they hadn't spotted on their way in. The upper floor stretched above them loft-style, and there was apparently an open space there for socializing. Crowley spied a billiard table. The lower level housed what could only be described as a hotel lobby, with twin fireplaces at each side of the quarters. As they headed past one of them, the hallway curved and took them into the side wing, which once more unfurled into a larger space. It wasn't as big as the previous one, but there was definitely something that was a living room here, complete with a dark red couch by a tall window, as well as another fireplace. On a raised step in the far corner sat a handsome grand piano, its lid tightly shut. Crowley stood looking at it while the staff explained that the bathroom and bedroom were just up the stairs on the right. After mentioning that there was a phone in the room, should they need assistance with anything, the woman smiled courteously and waddled away, leaving them alone once more. "Are you all right?" Crowley tore his gaze away from the piano and looked back at Azir Fael, whose forehead was already beginning to crease with the hint of worry lines. Unacceptable. In reply, he pushed his eyebrows up high enough to peek out over his glasses, hoping that would be enough to make the wordless question understood. It was.
"It's just you haven't said anything," explained Azir Fael, "since we, got here."
The unspoken gap was large enough to fit the truth inside of it, since what happened in the car. Or rather, what didn't happen in the car.
"I'm just trying to keep from saying something idiotic is all," Crowley muttered. It wasn't too much of a lie. At least, not insofar as his plans to mitigate any further damage. He'd already had his fair share of being an idiot. A smitten, unthinking buffoon, pretending like he had a chance, convincing himself he could somehow kiss his ear fail, could have a taste of the forbidden fruit, pretending that, for a brief moment, his ear fail had looked as if he might kiss him back.
Figured, the less I say, the less risk there is.
"Ah."
Azirfield glanced away and around the room.
"Right. Quite pragmatic of you. Well, let's check the upstairs, shall we?
She mentioned that they'd already brought our bags up there. We can unpack and take a small break before dinner." Stuffing his hands into his pockets, Crowley headed up after the other. There were only two doors there, and the first one he picked turned out to be a bathroom. It was modern, with cracked stone tiles and walls lined with stained wood, creating a rustic atmosphere. While he stepped one foot into the shower to toy with the foreign water controls,
Aziraphale disappeared into the bedroom. Not for long, he reappeared almost immediately, startling Crowley into pushing his glasses back up into his hair. Said Aziraphale. His face couldn't seem to decide on a shade of pink. Straightening, but not too much, Crowley slinked out of the bathroom after him and entered the adjacent room. It was just as rustic as the bathroom, and on the dark, polished wooden floor was what he hoped was a fake fur rug. Right beside it, poised in the center, with the headboard against the far wall, was a bed piled high with knitted blankets. Next to the bed were his suitcases, and on top of them was Aziraphale's singular tartan bag. There was a large floor-to-ceiling deck door that led out onto the balcony. It presumably had a nice view in the daytime, but was dark at the moment. Not finding anything amiss, he looked at Aziraphale again. The man was fidgeting with his ring. Well, not his ring, Crowley's ring. But he was fidgeting. What? Asked Crowley, looking back at the room and trying to figure out what had specifically elicited such a strong reaction. Nothing, Aziraphale replied, though it was clearly not nothing, as he was now struggling to look around the room at a casual pace, carefully disguising whatever was bothering him. Nothing at all. What do you think? Feeling stupider by the moment, what was he missing? Crowley gave the space another survey. It looks fine, I guess. Might get a bit cold. Why? Aziraphale shook his head and turned to his bag, dragging it off of Crowley's things and setting it down. No, I'm just being silly. Don't worry about it, dear. Dear. A jolt of shock went through him at that, the same as it had the past 23 times Aziraphale had utilized the word. His heart, all at once, an arrhythmic fool, a feral animal in its cage of ribs, banged loudly against his sternum. He curled inward, hoping to smother it back into silence. You must be tired. The voice startled him back into consciousness. Apparently, Aziraphale had continued to talk, perhaps hoping to cover up the awkward atmosphere with a blanket conversation and pretend it wasn't there. You haven't slept a wink and you've been driving. Did you want to shower first? I'll get my clothes sorted out in the meanwhile. Crowley craned his neck around to sniff at his own shirt. He probably smelled like a walking rubbish bin. Feeling the itch physically now, he backed up a few more steps towards the bathroom so that the aura of whatever stench he was housing would not assault the other. Yeah, he muttered. Yeah, I'll do that. The solace he took in being alone under the spray of shockingly well-pressurized water was short-lived. There were pros, of course. He could scrub himself clean and calm down. While he rubbed the apple-scented suds into his neck, his fingers were busy enough pressing out the kinks in his muscles to avoid heading downwards. The hot water didn't exactly help discourage the half-erection he was sporting, but he knew from past experience that he was better off leaving it alone. It got the wrong message from all this proximity to Aziraphale, but it was used to disappointment. It wasn't like anything had happened. They'd just been in the car together, had exchanged rings, and Aziraphale had slid his own ring on too. Fuck, hissed Crowley, and tilted his face up into the scorching spray, rubbing his eyes vehemently. The image of Aziraphale's slightly parted lips, his downcast eyes as he eased his finger into the ring Crowley had been holding, the turn of his wrist, that familiar motion, the absolute certainty behind it, spiced with the solid, single-minded determination. It was the same soft strength that had brought Crowley to the edge over 6 years ago. It wasn't sexual, you absolute idiot. He thought to himself scathingly, but his prick hadn't got the memo. Or maybe it had, but it had ignored it. Thrown into the pile with all the other memos he kept sending it to give up. Just give up. Nothing was going to happen. Not that it had stopped him before. Somewhere deep inside him was an optimist. He presumed that part mostly took residence in his nether regions to maximize the amount of grief it could give him any time he had the nerve to get close to the object of his affection. Better get it over with, he thought, and closed his eyes as he slid the pathetic, throbbing length into his own fist. Leaning against the shower wall on one elbow, he allowed his hips to jerk slightly into the pressure of his hand. The pretending was easy. He had more than enough to work with. Some of it was embellished, had become more decorative over the years. Sometimes his imagination added props or took them away to make the fantasy easier to deal with. Still, the underlying theme was the same. The same strain of the sick obsession that had plagued him since that first and only night. Aziraphale. 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 His mouth, his weight, his hand clasping shut around Crowley's eagerly crossed wrists, his sigh cutting between Crowley's clenched knees, opening him up, pushing into him, cracking him apart, and taking him, taking all of him, as if he were something precious, something desirable, something to be hungry for. It didn't take long. He had already worked himself into a ridiculous, shuddering mess before the day had even started. Here, in the shower, high on the scent of Aziraphale's warm cardigan and Aziraphale's sharp eyes, his beautiful mouth forming the word, darling. Crowley came within a minute, choking back all pathetic noises like a seasoned pro. Then he just stood there, breathing hard, bracing against the wall and forcing his thoughts back into a box and remembering how to function as if everything was fine. As if he wasn't desperately, maddeningly whispering prayers to the curve of Aziraphale's thighs. As if he wasn't counting off the 10 colors that reflected in the man's hair, like the commandments. He was fine. He had to be. And then he turned off the shower, opened the glass door, and realized that no, he wasn't fine. He was an idiot who had run into the bathroom without even bothering to grab a... You forgot your towel, as the Aziraphale called through the door. Crowley threw his head back and groaned. Perfect. He was about to call back and say something like, Don't worry, I'll just use the little toilet rug. But before he could decide on a tone, dry or casual, the door opened and Aziraphale was suddenly there, more or less directly in front of him. I'll just leave it on the counter for when you're He stopped, blinked once. The realization that Crowley was finished, that he was standing a few feet away, stark naked, one foot out of the shower, seemed to finally hit him. For a good moment, Crowley waited for him to go red, to start stuttering, to back away and say something about indecency, or apologize. Instead, Aziraphale swallowed him with his whole gaze and licked his lips. It was barely even visible, just a half second of a scope and the briefest sight of that pink tongue, but it was enough to hit Crowley like a freight train. He had to reach out a hand to steady himself on the counter of the shower to stop from toppling over, and then had to wrestle with his own tongue to fight back the urge to say something incredibly stupid like, See something you like? Thankfully, before he could open his damned mouth, Aziraphale visibly grabbed a hold of himself and turned away like the sight of Crowley had burned. He looked red enough in the face that it might have been true.
I didn't realize.
He fumbled for the door.
I thought the shower was still on. The noise from the pipes is louder and then I'll just...
Crowley yanked the towel off the counter, somehow reassured by the fact that he was not the only one incapacitated. It helped ground him, allowed him to think that perhaps he'd just imagined the hungry, lustful glimpse after all.
"Nothing you haven't seen before," he muttered dismissively, unable to stop himself.
As Earfail froze in the doorway, his neck muscles jumped, as if he was physically stopping himself from turning around for a second look. He didn't, but Crowley could have sworn he heard him mutter, "Worth turning into a pillar of salt over," before he disappeared from the bathroom with a hurried slam of the door. Right, that happened. By the time he'd gone back into the bedroom, a full 15 minutes later, including the time he'd taken to argue with himself that he did not need another wank to get over how Aziraphale had stared, he expected it to be empty. Surely the logical step to running away from their problems would have been to escape downstairs and let Crowley dress in peace. Instead, Aziraphale was still there, but now focused pointedly on the drawers near the bed. He was stuffing them full of what Crowley assumed to be more frumpy sweaters and tartan-patterned socks. It seemed like he was setting a precedent of silence, so Crowley decided to follow his lead and walked over to the largest black suitcase to get something to wear, and discovered it already unzipped. Feeling a stomach drop, he reached down to flick the lid up. Everything looked neatly folded, tucked into precise alternating rows of shirts and dark-stained jeans, which is to say, the exact opposite of how he'd packed it. Behind him, Aziraphale cleared his throat.
"My apologies," he said. "I thought I could grab you a shirt for when you'd finished your shower. Didn't mean to nose around."
Already knowing what he had found, Crowley reached down and pulled the top black Henley off of the pile, revealing the box of rubbers underneath it. His mouth was dry. He had known the wiser thing to do was to pack it down further. Why hadn't he? Why was he so stupid? His jaw unlocked, but no excuses spilled forth. He wasn't sure which one was more appropriate. Full-out denial? Or perhaps he could say he'd forgotten them from the last trip he'd gone on. Explain that he merely got into the habit of carrying around a box. That was right up his alley for the image he tried so hard to paint over the fucked-up reality of a touch-starved bastard he really was.
"They're not for..."
He bit his tongue again. Not for what? Not for him? Not for Aziraphale? Why had he packed them? Why had he packed them while drunk? Was perhaps a better question.
Balloon animals.
He choked out. A brief silence stumbled into the room, looked around, and then careened right back out again.
"Balloon animals,"
echoed Aziraphale. The tint of his voice hinted at a smile. "Really?
I thought I'd try a new hobby."
Crowley bit his tongue and resisted the urge to grab fistfuls of his own hair.
"Balloon animals, of all the stupid..."
"What are you gonna make? A snake?" Aziraphale's slow, steady shuffling in the dresser started up again, and the tension eased somewhat.
"Good Lord, Crowley, you don't have to explain yourself to me. It's not as if we're..."
The silence returned once more. It was different this time, and it overstayed its welcome. Aziraphale's shoulders hunched, bearing the brunt of it.
"Don't say it,"
Crowley begged inside his own head. He didn't want to let go of the fairy tale. They'd never said it out loud, had never dismissed the possibility outright. Maybe that's what had kept him clinging onto the last, impossible sliver of hope. Maybe it was what possessed him to throw the rubbers into the suitcase, as if something could still happen. It wouldn't, he knew. But he needed something to keep him complacent. Some placebo, fake as it was, to keep the feverish compulsion at bay. Balloon animals, he repeated, grabbed a pair of jeans and shut the top of the suitcase. And then they went to dinner.
So, I was thinking, said Thaddeus Dowling. Shocking. Crowley wanted to reply, but said nothing. He wished someone would give him some sort of prize for how much self-control he was exerting, but he was certain that his efforts would go unnoticed. Still, he had agreed to it. And it was for his ear fail's sake, which was enough to hold him in line. Anyway, Aziraphale was busy with Harriet Dowling a few feet away. She had successfully recruited his attention for some animated discussion about book clubs 5 minutes earlier, which meant Crowley alone was responsible for holding down the fort at this side of the table. "Eh," he voiced, glancing at the man to his left, attempting to summon some iteration of genuine interest and failing spectacularly.
"Dunno the politically correct way of saying this. Never really talked with one of your types before," prefaced Dowling.
Really, rather kind of him, Crowley thought venomously, since it gave him time to brace for the next slew of stupidity, and asked,
"Which one is the wife?"
Crowley shifted his lower jaw imperceptibly to the side, biting his tongue. He had not braced hard enough.
"The year of our Lord, 2013. He thought to himself in awe. It was a bloody shame the church denied the existence of fossils so vehemently when they could just as easily hop across the pond and find them sat at this very table, disapprovingly staring down Crowley's painted nails.
Before he could recover and find some way to answer which wouldn't start a fistfight over the dish of baked potatoes between them, Harriet Dowling homed in on her husband like a hunting dog, as if she could smell the oncoming storm.
"Thaddeus!" she scolded.
Aziraphale followed her gaze with mild curiosity, clearly having not heard the question. It was better to keep it that way. That singular goal was enough to spur Crowley back into the ability to speak.
"No, it's all right,"
he said with what was frankly a Herculean effort.
"Rookie mistake. Don't worry, questions are good. Everyone can stand to learn something when questions are involved."
Looking unsure, Harriet glanced between them.
"Maybe we should let you two lead instead," she decided finally. "I'm sorry, we've been completely ignoring you, Ashtoreth."
"You can just call me Ash." "Why the glasses?" interrupted Mr. Dowling with all the subtlety expected of him.
He was clearly put out on the fact that his previous question had been more or less ignored.
"It's a medical condition," replied Crowley.
Seeing the wife begin to look guilty in turn, he hurried to add,
No, don't worry. I'm not sensitive about it. I know it unnerves most people. I just have bad eyes is all. They're prescription."
"They make you look very cool,"
she told him, and he turned up one corner of his mouth, changing his grin into something more habitual.
"Compliments will get you nowhere, Mrs. Dowling. I'm a happily married man."
She laughed, but Crowley was already busy glancing at Aziraphale, who had dropped his gaze and picked up the glass of wine in front of his plate.
Did he look upset? Nervous?
Was Crowley just letting his overactive imagination run wild again?
"You aren't allowed to be married yet, aren't you?"
interjected Dowling from the side again.
"Over in England, I mean."
Crowley slowly turned back to him. "Legally speaking, no, not yet. But marriage is much more than just a document from the government," added Aziraphale. He was still holding his own wine glass, but he seemed to have recovered from whatever mild discomfort had accosted him earlier. Instead, there seemed to be a spark in his eye that Crowley was well familiar with. There's benefits to marriage, of course, but it's not as if marriage itself is only real after the signatures are collected. There's coexistence, partnership, romance. He was quieter as he said the last part. Or maybe Crowley was imagining it again. Aziraphale wasn't wrong, of course, and that's why it stung so badly. Why his heart ached in his chest, reaching through the bars of its prison for things it could not have. But no, he couldn't be greedy. They were partners in their writing. That had to be enough. It had been up until now. He rationed it well. Learned to live with scraps. Feeling an itch in his throat to say something idiotic that he would surely regret, he reached for his own wine glass, knocking the rest of it back like a shot. Thankfully, no one seemed to notice. "That's true, I suppose," Thaddeus allowed, looking reluctant to be agreeing with something that clearly drew hairline cracks in his fragile worldview. "Speaking of marriage, Fel, if I recall correctly, you used to be a priest." He leaned on the table with both elbows, as contemplative as a boulder of his size could hope to look. "Oh, yes," Aziraphale replied, turning his gaze towards his food. "For quite some time, in fact, I finished seminary and was ordained, and served the Catholic Church for a number of years before deciding that I wanted to commit myself to God through other means."
"Is a man really a man of God if he leaves the church? Isn't the church the house of God?"
Harriet Dowling appeared ready to graduate from throwing glares to throwing cutlery, but Aziraphale remained unbothered, serene as ever, looking down with a small, knowing smile as he gently cut into the filet mignon posed in the middle of the huge white dish. "A man does not cease to be a man when he leaves his house," he said quietly. "Churches are lovely things, but assigning them transformative power over believers takes away from the burden of humanity to build their own houses for God to reside in, inside their hearts." Thaddeus hummed. Crowley could practically see the loading bar poised over his head. He doubted it would ever make it past 30% any time this decade. He reached down for his own fork and dug it eagerly into the potatoes on his plate. At least, until Harriet decided that the tension had been sufficient. "Ash," she said, leaning towards him, "if you don't mind me asking, what about your profession?" Crowley glanced up at Aziraphale and then back down at his fork full of potatoes for inspiration. "Lawyer," he said with as much conviction as he could. "I deal with copyright cases mostly. For books, magazines, that stuff." "Oh," she said, looking much how he felt inside. "That sounds kind of boring, to be honest. Have you always been interested in law?"
"Ugh, no,"
admitted Crowley, who had been Googling "what do lawyers actually do" through most of his flight to the States. He was prepared to ad-lib his way out, but this was new territory and he had to tread carefully. He decided to throw a red herring instead. "Used to be in theology, too." He chewed the potatoes and set down his fork, trying to measure out the amount of information to give like he was preparing a very volatile recipe. "He double majored," inserted Aziraphale. Crowley had just enough time to catch a strange smile flickering across his face, paired with a restless wiggle, the kind that Aziraphale did when he was pleased with something. He couldn't, for the life of him, think of what might have spurred it on. "In astrophysics, he took night classes." Predictably enough, Harriet frowned in confusion. "Can you do that?" she asked.
"Technically, no. It really wasn't a sustainable goal," Crowley replied, fighting the urge to deny everything and sacrifice their cover story for the sake of not melting into a puddle of humiliation. Was Aziraphale trying to kill him? Why did he sound so bloody genuine? Why did he bring up that stupid fact in the first place? "But sleep is for the weak, am I right? Anyway," he added, feeling his cheeks begin to burn,
It didn't work out in the end. I quit both of them cold turkey and went to law school instead. At the very least, this version was cleaner than what had actually followed.
Theology and astrophysics to law? She said, awed. You must be some sort of genius. I had a hard enough time with just one degree.
He's brilliant, said Aziraphale. And this time, he definitely did look satisfied. Or was it pride? Was Aziraphale, Satan forbid it, proud of him? Of his stupid resume? Was he bragging?
Crowley felt the burn spread to his entire face, and to his horror, realized he must have been going red.
When he puts his mind to it, that is. Instead of forgetting it on the bedside table in the morning, Aziraphale added, evidently taking pity.
Crowley grasped the lifeline chance to bicker. Anything was better than suffering on the receiving end of compliments.
It's only because I'm lost in your eyes every morning, Angel,
he said, injecting as much sappy sweetness into his voice as he, himself, could stomach.
Aziraphale's lips quirked up, but he said nothing. Harriet was stretching out of her seat, looking more and more curious by the second. She shared a look with her husband, which Crowley didn't quite know the meaning of, but apparently it signaled a change of topic, because a moment later, they were all engaged in some sort of story about Thaddeus's recent trip down to Washington, D.C., and the conversation had been once more smoothed over. This continued for a while, until they finished the main course and carrot cake, topped with a hearty dollop of whipped cream, was distributed in American-sized plates. The dessert put Aziraphale back into the best of his moods, so Crowley was able to once again lean back in his chair and field questions from Thaddeus, who decided to try out a bit of tacton for size. His interrogative tactics evolved from crude prehistoric presumptions with sex and gender into a slightly more palatable medieval variety of sexism and homophobia. In between that, he did his best to pretend normal conversation, adding, "Where did you meet?" and "Do you read his books too?" to the mix, although the classic,
"I've heard you gay men aren't very discerning about having a bit of fun on the side. Is that true?"
did crop up eventually. The latter of these inquiries finally pushed Crowley into the territory of an irritated scowl, and he let Thaddeus know, in no uncertain terms, that he and Aziraphale were exclusive in a quiet, growling voice. Then he pushed back his chair, played the jet lag card, and excused himself from the table. Aziraphale glanced after him worriedly and promised to retire soon as well, but Crowley merely waved him away with a dismissive mutter of,
"No, no, have fun, Angel. I'm just turning in early tonight."
The problem, he thought to himself morosely as he climbed the stairs up to the bedroom, was that it was true. At least broadly speaking. At least on his side. He had been faithful, for 6 bloody years, to a non-existent relationship, the ghost of a promise of something that could be. It hadn't been on purpose at first. He had tried to forget, tried to put Aziraphale out of his mind. A few months following their shag, when it became evident that Aziraphale wasn't going to respond to his texts and his emails, he tried to distract himself by going to clubs, tried to even start to make out with a few lone souls behind the wall at the bar, tried to go through the motions of finding an empty stall to go into, tried to remember how he'd liked dropping to his knees and taking a stranger's cock into his mouth, tried to feel excited by the motions of sliding against the woman at the bar and feeling her guide his hands up her skirt. The problem was, he couldn't. He was no longer interested in anything that had previously offered him those brief respites from the aching loneliness in his chest. That single night with the man had run him over like a freight train, crushing all higher functions aside from mope and sigh and stare out the window like a repressed Regency-era maiden waiting for a single man in possession of a good fortune to drive by the estate. And worse yet,
when he wasn't pining or yearning or pacing around his flat holding his phone, wondering, should I send another email? He was busy fucking his own fist or clenching around his own fingers. With a single word clanging around the edges of his mind, branded into the back of his skull. Darling. It hadn't been the word. It had been the way Aziraphale had breathed it into him. Like Crowley was a dessert he was about to eat. Like Crowley was something precious and sexy and absolutely irresistible. Except, of course, that he wasn't. Aziraphale had no trouble resisting him. In fact, those few brief moments after they'd started to spend time together again and Crowley thought he could catch glimpses of the man tracing his profile with his eyes or staring at his backside, those were not hard and fast evidence. No move had been made, no indication of any leftover desire given. And yet, Crowley remained faithful. It wasn't because of morals, no, that had nothing to do with it. He had little time for morals. Instead, it was the same thing as before. Selfishness. Greed. Pointing to something he couldn't have and screaming and stomping his feet and collapsing to the floor in a fit of tears, refusing any alternatives. If I can't have that one, I'll have none at all. Nothing admirable about that. He was just a child. Just as well, then, that the universe had responded to his pleas with a stern smack on the back of his head and dragged him out of the store empty-handed. You said you quit. The voice jumped him from behind, and even though he should have seen it coming, he still flinched and fumbled for the lighter in his hands. It bounced off of the railing of the balcony he had been standing on, and miraculously back into his hands. He clutched it harder, trying not to shiver against the bitter December wind. I did, he said around the incriminating cigarette in his mouth, not turning around. He could see the shadow of the frosted surface of the balcony floor, haloed by the warm, golden glow filtering in from the other room. He knew how Aziraphale stood in order to make that shadow, shoulders tensed, hands drawn together. His silhouette was lumpy. Perhaps he was wearing a sweater. Good on him, it was too bloody freezing. Crowley was already regretting ducking out for nicotine. It's just been a hell of a day, he added as a pathetic excuse. I can't argue with that. Aziraphale shut the door, stepped closer, and finally came into view on his right side. Crowley'd been correct about the sweater. It was one of many, a light gray cardigan. It wasn't as thick as the jacket he himself was currently hiding inside, but then again, Aziraphale did resist the cold better. He tried to lean on the railing for a moment, but immediately pulled his hands away with a shiver. It was completely frozen over, and even after clearing away some of the snow, there was a thick layer of ice underneath. At least it stopped snowing, he remarked. Quite a chill, though. What did I tell you about America? Crowley reminded him. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see Aziraphale turn his head to regard him, and then a second later, a hand was reaching up to his face. Crowley, predictably enough, became very still. A freeze which had nothing to do with the temperature. But the fingers ghosting his face merely tugged the cigarette hanging from his lips free. Hey, he muttered. That's mine. We're sharing it, Aziraphale told him. Checking to see that it was still unlit, he pivoted slightly to the other. Light, please. Crowley's pathetic excuse for a stomach flipped in excitement. Did Aziraphale remember he liked to be ordered around? Did Aziraphale know what he was doing to him with that voice, that soft but sturdy tone? Or was it merely a coincidence, a lucky bone cast to him, the starving stray, to hold him over for another winter? It didn't matter, he thought firmly. and reached over to flick the lighter, cupping his hand around it. Xerophia leaned in, and his soft platinum hair lit up a deep, sunset orange as the flame danced between them. Then the moment was over. Cigarettes now live, Xerophia leaned back and took a practice drag. "Awful," he remarked, pulling it out with a very dainty, two-fingered grip and examining it critically. "Organic tobacco," Crowley said. "Way less rat poison." Xerophia snorted, but he passed the cigarette to him all the same. "I thought you would have gone to sleep."
Yeah. Time difference got me all sorts of fucked up."
Crowley grit out, gently placing his lips on the spot where Xerophia's own had just been moments ago.
Don't think about it.
I couldn't focus, and remembered I had this thing tucked away somewhere in the suitcase. Emergency stash, you know. I actually did quit." He exhaled a long string of white smoke and watched it dissipate into the open sky, which was now more or less clear. If it hadn't been too bloody cold to hold his eyes open, he would have enjoyed stargazing here. No lights from any human settlements reached the deep woods. They were a blanket of complete silence laid out underneath a stretching expanse of the cosmos. Not even 5 minutes, and he was already seeing the scattering of stars that dotted out the main of the Milky Way as it spilled from the horizon and disappeared over his head. Xerophil took another drag beside him and coughed, but didn't seem eager to surrender. "How was the rest of the social?" asked Crowley. "You came back earlier than I expected. Did Mr. Dowling not show you his taxidermy room?" "No. Thank God," said Xerophil. "I ducked out as quickly as I could after you left. Gave them some excuse about how I wanted to readjust my circadian rhythm. I almost expected Mr. Dowling to ask me what cicadas had to do with sleeping." Crowley chortled. "Poor sod. You really went in on him over the marriage thing. I thought I'd have to hold you back, or at least confiscate a few knives before you jumped over the table." A peek at Xerophil confirmed that the other was smiling quietly. "Though I suppose I didn't do too much better at pretending to play nice. He didn't even seem to care. Kept asking questions like he couldn't even see me trying to choke on the cake on purpose." At this, Xerophil went oddly quiet, pensive even. He took the cigarette when Crowley passed it back to him, but didn't return it to his lips. Instead, gazing out at the snowy landscape before them with just the barest hint of a frown that started between his eyebrows and then trickled down to the corner of his lips, pulling at it. "What?" said Crowley. "You're thinking something. What is it?" Xerophil shook his head absently. "No, nothing. Just thinking about the questions they were asking, I suppose." "You reckon they suspect it's fake?" asked Crowley. "The marriage?" Xerophil asked. "Why would they? They invited us here." "Yes, but they were trying to call your bluff. Isn't that what you said? Maybe they didn't consider the possibility you would actually turn up with me in tow." Xerophil was standing very still, holding the cigarette between his fingers, and the smoke was billowing gently upwards. He said in that reserved way he had when the gears in his head were spinning fast enough to power the Bentley. "That is true. Mr. Dowling hardly seems the type to be curious about the love life of two men." Crowley snorted. "But then again, if that were true," he argued, purely for the sake of his own curiosity, "they would probably ask about our relationship in general. The things he was talking to me about. It wasn't exactly stuff that would authenticate anything." "No, you see, that's the thing," pointed out Xerophil, gesturing away the smoke with an unexpected burst of energy. "They would expect us to have our stories straight." He paused when Crowley snickered, made a face, and then allowed an amendment. "Fine, have our story gay. But they would not expect us to be prepared for deeper interrogation, so to speak."
"And you think they're, what, mining for specific details? Anything we might not have prepared an answer to?"
Precisely, my dear. Harriet, after dinner before desserts. I asked to see where the kitchen is to wash my hands. She followed after me, and while she was explaining to me about the cake, she started to ask me questions. Aziraphale's eyes were alight now, sharp and clear, with no hint of sleep or exhaustion in them. But they were questions about you, where you'd grown up, why you'd quit the astrophysics route. I believe she was trying to get me to make something up on the spot so she could then compare it against whatever you might say. Crowley gifted him a dubious glance. To go through all that trouble, just to discredit the author they're hoping to make a book deal with, seems overkill, no? They are Americans, Crowley, Aziraphale said. Overkill is kind of their thing. I can't argue with that, Crowley muttered, plucking the abandoned cigarette from Aziraphale's hand. So what do you propose we do about it? No answer seemed to be forthcoming. In fact, Aziraphale looked almost comically lost, as if all the steam he'd been building up from his sleuthing and building a hypothesis to the promise of a mystery had no place to go. Oh, nothing, I suppose, he deflated. It's not as if we can predict what they'll ask, though I think I can field most questions about you. I dare say I can do the same, Crowley agreed. We have known each other for nearly 10 years now, Aziraphale pointed out, and then grew quiet. Not really that surprising. Crowley shivered and took another drag. No, it wasn't surprising. Unless Aziraphale had other friends he was hiding somewhere in the back of his bookshop, Crowley was his longest known acquaintance. Even without the farce of their marriage, they were probably the two best equipped people to play these roles. It was ironic, really. Or not, depending on how you viewed the way Crowley had jumped on his opportunity like a heat-drunk man in the middle of the desert, finally discovering an oasis. But no, it wasn't an oasis, really, was it? More like a mirage. He'd been wandering for a great deal longer than 40 days, and he was delirious enough with need to be ill-equipped to identify what was and wasn't a hallucination. In sharp contrast to the metaphor he was weaving in his head, the sub-zero temperatures were doing a good job of turning his facial muscles into a solid block of ice. Moving his jaw was already difficult enough, and he almost didn't notice the knuckles on his cheek until it was too late. And then it was too late. Aziraphale was pulling his hand away as quickly as he'd made contact. You're freezing, he scolded. This is why quitting smoking was always a better idea. Put that thing out and get inside. And don't you dare toss it. Give it to me. He grabbed the cigarette which Crowley was thoroughly putting to shame by the plume of smoke that were suddenly coming out of his ears. He felt none of the cold of the night at that moment. It was good that he didn't have to walk of his own accord. Aziraphale grabbing his arm and dragging him back into the room was the only force in the universe that might have moved him from the stupor he was in. Thankfully, the other didn't seem nearly as incapacitated. He had already bustled off to the bathroom, presumably to soak their incriminating nicotine and wrap it in a paper towel. Alone now, Crowley took the time to snap himself out of it and look at his bag. It probably contained something he could pass for pajamas. He typically slept in his underwear, but that was a bit of a stretch, seeing as he and Aziraphale were going to have to share a... The thought hit him like a meteor, a very effective extinction event for what remained of his brain cells. Oh, fuck. As if sensing the mental breakdown, Aziraphale popped his head around the door. What's the matter? He asked. Only then did Crowley realize he'd spoken the words out loud. He looked over his shoulder and then looked back at the object of his shock and then said, in an undignified voice, Aziraphale, there's only one bed. Aziraphale turned pink, but it was a recycled blush, one that had been well worn and lost its color in the wash. Yes, he said. I was wondering when you'd notice.
That's why you were... That's why you...
Don't worry, said Aziraphale. His voice was hurried, like he was trying to put a plaster on something that was still bleeding. You can take it. I'll take the armchair, or I'll just go to the couch downstairs. What? I know you have trouble sleeping, he continued, looking for some reason down at the ground as he came around the corner and began to go through his own luggage in search of something. My schedule's still askew since I managed to catch a nap in the car. I'll just read instead. You can read in the bed, Crowley protested. The hands yanking random things out of the tartan bag stilled for a long moment. You wouldn't mind? Mind? Demanded Crowley, offended. Mind what? Fulfilling my most E-rated fantasy? He thought incredulously. Aziraphale, we've... His brain slammed the brakes, just barely. We have to convince them we're married, don't we? It's a big bloody bed. I'll just stay on my own side and you can read, or do whatever you want. Please, please do whatever you want, begged his brain in the throes of a spasm, presumably from lack of oxygen. To me, do whatever you want to me. He was forgetting to breathe. This was stupid. Aziraphale would never agree anyway, he'd... All right, agreed Aziraphale. Crowley bargained with his knees not to buckle. In the process, he lost his knack for multitasking and his throat buckled instead, letting out a pathetic, desperate noise that sounded approximately like, "Ning." Go to bed then, said Aziraphale, who did not seem the least bit concerned, at least not from his tactical position of not showing his face. I'll have to take a shower and brush my teeth first. Some primal part of Crowley, whatever cockroaches were left in his head that survived the meteor from earlier, moved his limbs for him. It was easier once Aziraphale had ducked back out of the room and left him alone. Easier to pretend that nothing was amiss. He was just pulling on an old band shirt and trackies, and he was just falling into bed. He was just yanking the covers up on his side, and staring longingly at the other pillow. Presumably at some point Aziraphale would return. He might be wearing less. Please let him be wearing less. He might slide in under the covers, merely a few feet away. He might shift his head on the pillow, each one of those damned perfect curls pressing up against the soft, coffee creamer-colored cotton. He might even leave his pajama top unbuttoned, leave his throat uncovered. Might be close enough for Crowley to reach out and touch him, or at least to run his eyes along the curves of that plush neck, where the softness hid an undeniable cord of muscle than his shoulder. If he played his cards right, he could pretend to be asleep and instead watch the other through his lashes, could remember how that skin had tasted under his tongue, how those thighs had given under the press of his fingers, how that stomach had trembled as Aziraphale pushed his cock into Crowley's throat, holding back, controlling it all with precise, unforgiving motions and fuck, now he was hard again. Christ! He hissed under his breath and rolled over, grinding down into the mattress once. That was all he was allowed before he had to calm the fuck down and get a grip over his overactive imagination. How many times could he replay that memory in his head before the tape worn to dust? Something had to give. It couldn't last forever. 6 years was already pushing it for how vivid the image remained in his mind. Before he could summon the nerve to imagine Dowling's taxidermy collection in hopes of discouraging any further reactions, the bedroom door clicked open, and his eyes, on reflex, fell shut. Aziraphale stepped into the room, paused, and then began shuffling around beside his bag quietly. The fact that he was doing his best to tiptoe around made it clear he had presumed Crowley to be asleep. A part of him was thrilled at this. The first step to his perfect plan was complete. But he was turned away from the other, facing the window, which meant that he couldn't exactly do any spying, save for his chance to utilize the dark, reflective surface of the glass. Currently, it showed the man crouched over his bag, picking out books he'd brought along with him. Eventually, as Aerophil stood and edged back over towards the bed and leaned over it, the man's heart hammered ecstatically in response, almost lodging in his throat. It was a miracle the other didn't notice, and he didn't, because he pulled back again with a very soft, satisfied hum, lifted up his side of the covers, and climbed in. The wood creaked softly as it accepted his weight, and Crowley felt an echoing groan somewhere in his stomach. He was so close, almost close enough to touch. Judging by the reflection in the window, as the Aerophil was indeed reclining against the headboard. Then he shifted, pulled up one of the pillows and made a backrest for himself. Then he shifted again, the motion reminiscent of the wiggle he was so prone to, as if getting comfortable. It took a while, and perhaps if Crowley wasn't a completely lovesick fool, he would have thought it annoying how much movement was going on behind him. Instead, he was ecstatic. Every shift of the covers, every drag of the blanket on his back felt like a direct touch. They were arguably no closer than they always were. Crowley was at least a foot away. But he still felt the heat radiating from those beautiful thighs somewhere behind his head. Still mutely reveled in the idea that only a layer of fabric separated his lips and tongue from that lush skin. He would never be able to sleep in this state, but that was fine. As the Aerophil idly paged through his book and settled in to read, and Crowley steadied his breathing and felt his chest grow warm and full of some sort of sappy happiness he would have sworn he was allergic to a week ago. He had no idea what time it was or how long he stayed like that, almost entirely still, shifting only sometimes to give his pretend sleep an element of natural dreaming. It could have been minutes, or it could have been hours. The fact was insignificant in the context of what happened next. At some point, as the Aerophil flipped a page, sighed contently, and then reached down and placed his hand on Crowley's hair. Immediately, in what was his most regretted decision that entire night, Crowley stopped breathing. Perhaps if it hadn't been ridiculously quiet in the room, the change would have gone unnoticed. As it was, Aerophil's fingers tensed and began to withdraw in a much more hurried manner than they had arrived. It was a damned tragedy, and Crowley was just about ready to swear out loud at himself for making the mistake. His tongue turned unwillingly in his mouth like a swollen slug, and he rolled his shoulder up to flip over. But before he could make the full pivot, his back pressed against something blissfully soft and warm. Aerophil's hip. He'd been so much closer than Crowley had thought. He hadn't planned this far, and the contact made him melt immediately, forget his entire plan, and instead sink into the plush thigh against him, eyes still closed, jaw falling slack. He must have looked like he was asleep, because Aerophil froze above him, waiting, waiting, waiting. And then, it seemed like the higher power he so vehemently cursed out on the daily decided to play a joke and grant his wish, because that wonderful, warm hand was placed back on his head, fingers gently threaded into Crowley's hair. It took every single one of his remaining 8 brain cells to not do anything else stupid. He stayed there, concentrating all the CPU available to keep his breathing steady and pretending to be as asleep as he possibly could. It got easier the longer this went on. Aerophil kept stroking, sometimes scratching against the scalp lightly, and Crowley dissolved into primordial goo with every ministration, every light brush. He didn't remember falling asleep, but he knew with absolute certainty that when it happened, he was the happiest and most relaxed he'd been in years. End of part 5.